Good morning.
Good morning. John Schmidt is trying to sabotage my argument by making me miss it.
How are you?
Good, good to see you.
Take a minute to get settled. The next case on our calendar today is Joshua Lee Jones versus State of Minnesota. Council will each have 15 minutes for their argument, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant. I'll ask the council please introduce yourselves and the party you represent when you begin. And whenever you're ready, council, for the appellant, you can proceed. The podium is adjustable, so feel free to adjust it if need be.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Eric Withall. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Appellate Public Defender's Office. I appear before this court today representing the appellant in this matter, Joshua Lee Jones. Your honors, we are asking this court today to reverse the district court's construction of Mr. Jones' sentencing challenge as a post-conviction petition, as opposed to how we filed it, which was a Rule 27 motion. A Rule 27 motion is a vehicle to challenge a sentence at any time that's not authorized by law. And our argument today is that the district court erred by extending the holding in Coles, which restricts sentencing challenges that implicate plea agreements to post-conviction petitions as opposed to Rule 27 sentencing motions. And your honors, the only reason that I can figure out that this matters is there's a 2-year time bar on post-conviction petitions, and again, Rule 27 motions can be filed at any time.
So are you saying, Mr. Withall, that we should characterize these circumstances as a post-conviction petition?
No, Your Honor.
So you're arguing just the opposite of that?
Yes.
And then I misunderstood you.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. Yeah. So below, Mr. Jones filed a Rule 27 motion saying that arguing that the 10-year conditional release term attached to his sentence for failure to register as a predatory offender violated his Sixth Amendment rights to a sentencing jury trial under Blakely because he was not advised of his right to a jury trial, and therefore anything that can be construed as a waiver of that right, either through his admission that he was a level 3 at the time of his plea, would not be valid because it was not pursuant to a valid waiver advisory of the right, acknowledgement that the right exists, I waive my right, nothing like that.
But if that's the case, I mean, right in the sworn testimony at the guilty plea, right in the guilty plea petition, your client acknowledges the 10-year conditional release period. That seemed like that was an integral part of this global agreement. How is this not a challenge to the plea agreement then, as opposed to the sentence? Because it seems the state bargained for that.
The reason the state, there's many reasons the states did not bargain for the conditional release term. The first is an interpretation of the terms of the plea agreement. The post-conviction court below found that there was no agreement for a specific sentence. And that the terms—
Not time, I agree, but if it's right in the petition, that there's going to be a 10-year conditional release period, it seems like that would be a common understanding of all the parties.
Yes, Your Honor. The advisory that an individual would receive a mandatory sentence as a result of being a level 3 and acknowledging he's a level 3 is more advisory than it is an agreement, and it goes toward what the party's expectations would directly result from a conviction of a person with a level 3 status. But it is not an agreement or a specific term of the agreement.
But that says right in the petition, I've been told by my attorney and I understand. And then it goes on to say what it all is, that my attorney and the prosecuting attorney agreed. It says agreed. That's in the petition.
The specific language, Your Honor, regarding the fact of his status of a level three and the consequent 10-year conditional release term is I understand and I understand. That appears to be more in the vein of an advisory than the terms of the agreement. The plea petition is required to advise him of what the conditional release term is. On earlier lines of the petition where the conditional release term is referenced, there actually is no 10-year term written in there. That's the only place where it exists. The other reason this court should consider that this is not a term of the plea agreement is because it is a mandatory part of the sentence that must be imposed. The language in 243-166, I think it's sub 5A, that requires the court to impose the 10-year conditional release term says shall. It's a non-negotiable term of the sentence. It doesn't make sense that it would be a term of the plea agreement if it is non-negotiable and mandatory upon the court to impose the 10-year conditional release term whenever it is faced with an individual convicted of failure to register who has been determined to be a risk level three by the end of confinement review committee through the Department of Corrections. So, Your Honor, it does not follow logically or factually that a mandatory part of the sentence would be a negotiated term. I agree that the parties discussed it. I agree that the record shows that the parties expected it. But to say that the state bargained away some right, for example, like the right in Coles to argue for a longer sentence, or in Bilbro where the state argued for, waived the right to argue for an aggravated upward departure, it needs to be a negotiated term of the agreement where the state gives up something in exchange for this. And what the terms of the plea agreement contemplate here, Your Honors, is that Mr. Jones pled guilty not just to this failure to register charge, he pled guilty to another failure, actually there's two on appeal before this court, but he pled guilty to other district court files as well, and in exchange for his pleas to these cases, the state dismissed pending charges in other district court files. This appears to be a classic example of resolving through a global agreement multiple pending cases in the name of judicial economy, prosecutorial effective use of resources, the interests of resolving this. Now, bear in mind, Your Honor, you know this is a different case than Coles in to the extent that if Mr. Jones had just entered pleas to all of the pending charges, he would not actually be subject to a longer sentence. The 24 months is not the middle of the box based on his criminal history score, and neither is the 10-year conditional release. If he pled guilty to every single one of those pending failure to register as a predatory offender charges, you get 24 months plus 10 years conditional release, 24 months plus 10 years conditional release, 24 months plus 10 years conditional release, and so on. I don't know how many he had. It's a lot. To say that the state gave up something in exchange for the 10-year conditional release term is not an accurate reading of the record or the terms of the plea agreement. And because I think this court could also hold that the 10-year conditional release term, because of its mandatory nature, is actually non-negotiable. What is negotiable is, for example, what appears in the petition that Mr. Jones would admit and acknowledge that he was a level three predatory offender. That's something that he can waive his right to a jury trial on the issue of that fact. That's something that the state actually has a pretty good interest in negotiating away, because otherwise the state has to, under G. Herr, impanel a sentencing jury trial on the question of whether he's level three. That's a huge use of resources, and the state obviously has a strong interest in avoiding the unnecessary use of that of those resources. If Mr. Jones was advised of that right, I think he probably could have negotiated that away, maybe in favor of some better deal than the one that he got. I think that's other further evidence for why the 10-year conditional release term here was not a term of the agreement.
Counsel, do you agree that in our review of what was, that we review the district court's order for clear error in analyzing what was in the plea agreement?
Yeah, I think this court is deferential to the district court's interpretation of the actual terms of the plea agreement, but the effect is a matter of law, what we're arguing here today. So that's why it's.
So whether the 10-year conditional release was part of the plea agreement, we review that determination for clear error?
Yes, Your Honor. And what the district court found in its decision and its conclusion was not that it was a term of the agreement, but that the state bargained for it. That looks like the way the district court handled that was treating the 10-year conditional release term as a matter of equity, that it felt it would be inequitable for the state to have dismissed that many charges and not retain their expectation for the 10-year conditional release term. It was not an express term of the plea, the term of the agreement. And again, as a matter of law, this court can also hold that the 10-year conditional release term, because it's mandatory and non-negotiable, should not be considered term of the agreement that would preclude the ability to raise a sentencing challenge outside of 2 years. Your Honor, I'd like to move to my last argument, why this court should apply Rule 27, and that's ask this court to examine the scope and extent that Coles does restrict plea agreements that implicate sentencing challenges that implicate the plea agreement. Coles discusses sentencing challenges under interpretations of the guidelines where there otherwise was a negotiated plea agreement. In footnote 7 of Coles, the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized the state's alternative argument that sentencing challenges for sentences that exceed the statutory maximum, those fall within the exclusive purview of Rule 2703 sub 9 and therefore would not be subject to the rule in Coles. In other words, Mr. Jones's sentencing challenge falls outside of the scope of the holding in Coles because it is a sentencing challenge to a sentence that is in excess of the 5-year statutory maximum for failure to register. So there are sentencing challenges under the guidelines, arguing that under the law of the guidelines it's not authorized by law. And then there are true not authorized by law sentencing challenges like this one, where this is not a matter of the district court's exercise of discretion. As the Supreme Court said in State v. Herr and in Reynolds, without a waiver of the jury trial right to a sentencing jury on the issue of whether he's level 3, the district's court, the sentencing court, is simply not authorized to impose the 10-year term.
Of course, Herr was a jury trial. This wasn't. In this case, there's an admission under oath that I acknowledge under oath I'm a risk level 3 offender. So that is significantly different than the factual circumstances that the Supreme Court looked at in Herr. So my question is, if we analyze the case as you're asking us to under Rule 2703, is your argument that this is an unauthorized sentence because there was no Blakely waiver?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Also,
so if that's the case, I thought that was your argument, and I just wanted to confirm that for myself. So if that's the case, how is your client prejudiced here by the lack of a specific waiver?
Well, prejudice has never been the analysis where an individual in any
case. Well,
this
isn't a structural error, though. It's a procedural error. So he needs to show that, or there needs to be a finding that the failure to give the warning was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And how is that not the case?
One aspect is that he was deprived of the opportunity to argue for a better plea agreement that contemplated that the state would not have to impanel a sentencing jury in order to tack on 10 years to his 24-month sentence.
All right. So is your remedy then a remand to let him withdraw his guilty plea if that's what he wants? Because this could get a lot worse for him, it seems like, down the road, if that's what your remedy is.
No, it could not, Your Honor.
Well, I understand your argument about the 24, but there's a bunch of other charges that are going to be on his record that he could potentially be convicted of.
Potentially, Your Honor, but this is not a remedy for plea withdrawal. If anything, the remedy would be, as the state agrees, would be a remedy for a remand for the state to have the opportunity to impanel a sentencing jury trial to attempt to prove whether Mr. Jones was a level 3 predatory offender at the time that he failed to register.
Okay,
could they use his, one more question. Could they use his admission then under oath at his guilty plea that he was?
Under Detman, no, because the the admission was not made pursuant to a valid waiver of his right to a jury trial. It would just be like a person's admissions at a guilty plea later withdrawn are not permitted to be used as evidence against him at the subsequent trial. This court on occasion does reverse guilty pleas, and that testimony is simply not admissible.
Right. Sorry for the interruption.
That was the same.
Unless this court has any other questions, we ask this court to hold primarily that the 10-year conditional release term was not a part of the bargain. This court and the district court should construe the sentencing challenge under Rule 27, not the post-conviction statute. Alternatively, we ask this court to hold that the holding in Coles interpret it narrowly and not apply it to the sentencing challenge raised by Mr. Jones below. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Plant. I'm here representing the state of Minnesota today. As counsel acknowledged, I'm actually here on behalf of both Olmsted and Rice counties. As everyone is aware, this is a case that involves multiple cases that arose out of multiple jurisdictions, including the county of Olmsted, the county of Rice, the county of Winona, and the city of Rochester. So this indeed was a global plea agreement. And if this isn't a case, as I said in the court below, where the plea agreement is implicated, not just the sentence, I don't know what is. So I am here today asking that you affirm the district court and her construction of Mr. Jones's request for relief as a post-conviction petition, and that because it was filed 3 years rather than within the two-year time window that Chapter 590 provides, 3 years after he was sentenced, that it was time barred, and that the district court therefore did not abuse her discretion when she dismissed it summarily and without an evidentiary hearing. I'd like to clarify a couple of things with respect to what the district court found. First of all, it's correct that her order states that the court agrees there does not appear to have been an agreement for a particular sentence. I will admit I was stymied by that finding in the court's order, which actually she has as an analysis statement rather than a finding of fact, because in the plea petition, it clearly states that there is a joint agreement for an executed prison sentence of 24 months concurrent on the felony files, and then also later it talks about 90 days on the misdemeanor file that also received a plea of guilty with respect to the City of Rochester case. So I'm not clear on why it is that Judge Hain made that particular finding as far as a specific sentence, but the record with respect to the plea petition belies that particular finding. Nonetheless, the state clearly agrees with and asks this court to adopt her findings that the 10-year conditional release period was, in fact, an integral part, as she phrased it, of the plea negotiations. With respect to counsel's argument, it cuts both ways here. On the one hand, he's asserting that the 10-year conditional release term is mandatory and imposed by statute, and therefore, since it's a mandatory term imposed by statute, it's not something that the parties can actually negotiate for. Of course, he said it would be illogical that they would be able to negotiate for something that's mandated by statute, but of course, the Supreme Court has also said that it's not illogical to expect that we have two separate jury trials, one to determine guilt and one to determine whether or not someone actually was assigned a risk level of 3 when he committed or she committed a particular crime in question. So I do think that undercuts the argument of counsel to the extent that if it were mandatory and we weren't concerned about it as far as a negotiating tool, we wouldn't be worried about whether or not we had a separate waiver for a jury trial on that particular issue.
Was a separate jury trial waiver necessary here and not done?
I believe that it was necessary were it to be not considered part of the agreement, but in this case, I don't think that's accurate. I believe that I agree with the district court that this was something for which the parties negotiated. What specifically they negotiated for was a relatively quick, and I use that term loosely, resolution to multiple files that arose out of multiple jurisdictions. A quick resolution of 10 files and multiple counts, more than 10 counts with those files, is not, well, let's get a guilty plea as to the underlying adjudication, but then have, a, as as Mr. Withall noted, go to the great expense and time of impaneling a jury on this other factor here. I believe it's clear from the terms of art and the language that was used both in the plea petition as well as the language that was used by defense counsel, state's counsel, and the judge at that plea hearing that everyone was in agreement here that the purpose of this global plea resolution was not only to adjudicate guilt, but adjudicate the fact of whether or not Mr. Jones was assigned a risk level of 3 at the time that he committed these offenses, and that it was negotiated that we would not be having any jury trials in this matter, whether it was with respect to the guiltiness of Mr. Jones or his risk level, which gets to the whole, what is the benefit of the bargain here for the respective parties? And I think that's really what the district court was being asked to decide here. Is this a post-conviction matter where the exclusive remedy is a post-conviction petition, or is this really something where we're looking only towards correcting an unlawful sentence? First of all, were it simply a legal question of whether this was a sentence unauthorized by law, we wouldn't be discussing facts, because a sentence unauthorized law is not a question of fact, it's not a matter of fact, it's a question of law. That's exactly why you would have an exclusive remedy of a post-conviction petition in a situation like this, because you would require an evidentiary hearing to have testimony from the defendant, perhaps from the state's attorney, perhaps from the public defenders in the lower court to figure out, okay, what really was the negotiation here? Did he receive the proper advisory when he consulted with counsel with respect to waiving the jury trial on that Blakely aggravating factor or the 10-year conditional release? So let's talk for a minute about what all Mr. Jones retains with respect to the benefit of the bargain and what the state loses. First of all, he retains dismissals of 7 other files, again, in different counties, Winona County, Olmsted County, as well as, I believe, a City of Rochester file. At least one was dismissed. One of these cases that was dismissed was a Winona County case that also was a predatory offender registration violation case. So the only 3 predatory offender registration violations actually at issue in this particular case were the 2 to which he admitted guilt and the 1 in Winona County that he had dismissed. So one of the benefits of the bargain that Mr. Jones got here was that he only has 1 conditional release period ordered, which are running concurrently, the 10 years in Rice and the 10 years in Olmsted. However, the way Minnesota Statute Section 243.166 is drafted, if Mr. Jones were to be convicted in the Winona County file after he had been convicted in the Olmsted and Rice County files, that 10-year conditional release period would have started anew. So once he got out of prison or finished whatever supervision in the Olmsted County and Rice County files, the 10-year conditional release period, assuming he was convicted and then found to have the requisite risk level in Winona County, would have started from the time his supervision in the earlier files had lapsed. So essentially, the 10 years continues to get stacked when it comes to predatory offender registration. So one of the benefits he retains here is that he doesn't have an additional 10-year release period that would get tacked on to the end of his Olmsted and Rice convictions once he gets out of prison. That's a huge benefit of the bargain for someone who seems prone to committing crimes where he's not registering. And that's also a big benefit for the state, obviously, in not having to worry about whether or not we're adjudicating him at a risk level of 3 and getting his admission as to that point and not having to go through the huge expense, as acknowledged by counsel, of impaneling a jury for what should be a relatively easy finding of fact to make. Additionally, as well as the other dismissal of charges, he also had the let me focus on the state, excuse me. We also would lose the resolution of all of these cases in one go, and this would require, again, not just the Olmsted County attorneys having to litigate, it's, I think, 3 cases in this matter, but also the City of Rochester would have to be litigating cases, the Rice County Attorney's Office would have to be litigating cases, the Winona County's Attorney Office would have to be litigating cases. And on top of that, Mr. Jones actually had 3 different public defenders, because there were so many cases going on. And when the offer was first made in this case, which you may have seen from the record, Mr. Haas actually was extending an offer in only a handful of files arising out of Olmsted County. But because Mr. Jones continued to go out and allegedly offend or re-offend, given whatever specific case you're looking at, the plea agreement grew and grew and grew in scope over the course of time until they were finally able to memorialize this agreement on the record because there were so many cases that kept piling up. So again, it was, I believe, clearly not an error or an abuse of discretion for the district court to construe what was requested of her as a request for post-conviction relief under Minnesota statutes. Chapter 590. Now, moving on, and with respect to the Coles case, while we're still on that issue, Mr. Withall acknowledges that he's quoting or citing a footnote. The holding of Coles is still good law, and that law is that if the request for relief under a motion for Rule 2703, Subdivision 9, implicates more than simply the sentence and implicates rather the plea agreement, then the exclusive remedy is a petition under Chapter 590. That is exactly what we have here, and the Supreme Court actually reiterated this principle in 2016 in the Evans v. State case. So this was not an error of law. And because Mr. Jones filed his motion to correct sentence, or what he called a motion to correct sentence, after the two-year time period had elapsed and failed to argue any exceptions to that time bar, the district court did not err or abuse her discretion in dismissing that petition summarily. With respect to the waiver issue, as Judge Flory, you noted, this is not a structural error. And given the fact that the district court did not get an express waiver on the jury trial portion of it, if this court were to decide that Judge Hain did, in fact, err and misconstrue what was asked of her, I still believe that the state should prevail and that this court should still affirm, because as the record reflects, there was no prejudice to Mr. Jones here. As you noted, Judge Flory, the alternate is actually true. Were he to get what he's asking for in this case, potentially the district court would be required, absent instruction from this court, to reject the party's plea agreement. And there would be multiple cases reopened, and we would have to go essentially from scratch in those cases. But I don't believe that's necessary here, because in the State v. Kuhlman case, the court noted that this is not a structural error, it's a procedural error, and it's not one that's fatal. Furthermore, with respect to whether any harm was incurred, moving for a moment away from the prejudice to Mr. Jones, one of the things that the court would look at to determine whether or not his waiver was valid, absent an explicit and express waiver, was whether he had the benefit of counsel, which he did. As I already noted, the record reflects that Mr. Jones actually had the benefit of three different attorneys in multiple files, as well as multiple state's attorneys working diligently to resolve these multiple cases. He also stated on the record multiple times, yes, this is what I want to do to resolve all of these cases. Yes, I understand I'm waiving all my rights. No, I don't have any questions. I want to move on with the rest of my life, I believe was actually the phrase that he used. So there's multiple indications in the record that not only was this a voluntary plea, but this was something that Mr. Jones truly wanted. And as the court already noted earlier, this was also something that Mr. Jones was well aware included a 10-year conditional release term. Again, this was articulated by his own attorney. This was articulated by the state's attorney. This was in the plea petition, which I should add, and is also in the record from the hearing below. This is not your stereotypical plea petition, at least from Olmsted County. It's very rare that we see the meticulous detail written out that we see here in the record. And the reason is because probably at least 10 different attorneys looked at this plea agreement. So I am...
Ms. Plant, as Mr. Whittle pointed out, the plea petition does also include a sentencing. In this case, the period of conditional release is 0 years.
Yes, that's actually...
That's up above the description of the plea.
That's correct, Judge, and I have that highlighted and underlined because that is specific to a felony driving while impaired offense, and most sex offenses. So I do believe that was a drafting error, and I think that it's also belied by the fact that we have great detail down below here that clearly speaks to the 10 years conditional release period again, which was reiterated multiple times on the record. Everyone, I think it would be difficult to argue there wasn't a meeting of the minds here among the parties in the different counties, the city, and defendant and his many attorneys, as well as the district court, that the 10-year conditional release term was in fact a negotiated term, especially to the extent that it would require additional findings of fact, additional calling in of jury members to adjudicate this particular issue. So, barring further questions, my time is almost up. I'll rest on my brief. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Whittle, any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. There's just a few points I'd like to touch on, and I'd like to bring it back to the beginning of respondents' arguments about the district court below and the court's findings about what the terms of the plea agreement are. This court's acknowledged that the district court has found that there was no agreement to a particular sentence because the district court found that. We didn't talk much about it in appellant's brief, but I want to draw this court's attention to pages 8 and 9 of the plea transcripts, which shed some light on why the plea petition is not the most reliable document for this court to rely upon when discerning what the terms of the plea agreement are. And I think the plea petition sets forth that there's an agreement for a 24-month sentence. And the reason why the district court found that there was no agreement to the sentence, despite that pretty clear language in the plea petition, is because of this discussion between the court and Mr. Hazzi, the prosecutor, where it says that, at least my understanding essentially is we'd be asking for the guidelines, which we believe to be 24 months. The court interjected, right, is that right? Mr. Hazzi responds, based on the mandatory minimum. The court responds, that's maximum. If it turned out to be 26, we'd have to live with that. Mr. Hazzi responds, I guess that would be my position. The state's argument is, the state's position for the plea agreement is that it's Mr. Jones's plea and what he would receive would be the guideline sentence. The guideline sentence, if his criminal history score were higher, the state acknowledges that Mr. Jones would not receive a 24-month sentence, that the agreement is not for a specific 24-month sentence, that if the guidelines presumed a higher sentence, he would get that. And this court should also consider that, because what the state is arguing for in the terms of this plea agreement is for the conviction and not for the sentence. The conditional release term is part of the sentence, which is not bargained for by the state. And because what the state bargained for was Mr. Jones's acknowledgement that he was a level 3, the state just didn't bargain for enough. The state got what it bargained for, which was Mr. Jones's acknowledgement that he was a level 3. What the state should have bargained for if they wanted the 10-year conditional release term was they should have bargained for his valid waiver to a Blakely trial. G. Herr was decided shortly before sentencing and plea, and the state should have been aware of that new development in the law. We know that is new law in State v. Herr because Meagher tells this court that that's new law and it is not retroactive. So the time of Mr. Jones's plea about a month earlier, Supreme Court said that there needs to be a separate waiver of the right to a jury trial on the issue of whether he's a level 3. The state believed that was sufficient for the waiver, and that's what they bargained for. The state was wrong. The state got what they bargained for. That's why the sentencing challenge does not implicate the terms of the plea agreement. Your Honor, Judge Flory talked about the during my principal argument that this is not a structural error. I would remind this court that the state's brief cites only to Kuhlman to say that this is not structural error, and that there's no case saying that this is not structural error under these circumstances. Kuhlman goes to a waiver of an element of the offense. The fact of a level 3 is not an element of the offense. It is an additional element outside the elements of the offense for failure to register. Level 3 is in a separate subdivision, and it goes only to the sentence. It is not to the question of guilt. And this implicates not a
How is it different if the state's burden is to prove each element beyond a reasonable doubt and also the same burden to prove an aggravating factor beyond a reasonable doubt?
Your Honor, it goes
What's your authority for saying there's some difference or distinction in that?
I would ask this court to rely on State v. Herr and State v. Reynolds, which says that the state and the court simply lack the authority to impose the 10-year conditional release term unless the court impanels the sentencing jury and the state proves beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury referenced in the sixth.
I understand what you're saying, but what's the significance of those two cases that you cite, one of which is a jury trial and one of which is a guilty plea, but neither of which have the defendant's under oath admission that he's a risk level 3?
The admission is resolved by Detman, Your Honor, not by her and by Reynolds. Her and Reynolds stand for the proposition, both in the context of where he did have a jury trial on the issue of guilt and where he waived his jury trial to the issue of guilt. If there is no jury on the issue of whether he is a level three, which is a sentencing factor, a separate jury, a separate issue, a separate element outside of the issue of guilt, that's a different question.
Isn't Reynolds distinguishable, though, because in that case, the court, sua sponte, added the conditional release term. It wasn't part of the plea discussion.
The fact of that Mr. Reynolds was deprived of his right to a sentencing jury because the court did sua sponte, or whether because the court just took the testimony in this case as level three, doesn't change the fact that no jury was impaneled, and the only time you can impose conditional release on the fact of a level three is where there's a valid waiver or a jury is impaneled, and neither was done in any of those cases. And it is structural error in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.